Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. COVID-19 has had a catastrophic impact on workers, the head of the International Labour Organization, ILO, said on Wednesday, with lost working hours higher than originally forecast and equivalent to 495 million full-time jobs globally in the second quarter of the year. The bleak news from ILO Director General Guy Ryder coincided with an updated mid-year forecast from the UN body. Lower and middle income countries have suffered most, with an estimated 23.3% drop in working hours, equivalent to 240 million jobs in the second quarter of the year. Workers in developing nations have also seen their income drop more than 15%, Mr. Ryder told journalists in Geneva.
The greatest impact was in lower middle income countries. On top of this, these are places where there are the weakest social protection systems, so there are very few resources or protections for working people to fall back upon. If you look at it regionally, the Americas were the worst affected, with a drop in labour incomes of just over 12%, 12.1%.
Mr. Ryder highlighted that while the governments of richer countries had shored up their economies with hundreds of billions of dollars, poorer nations had been unable to do the same. Without such fiscal stimulus, working hours losses would have been 28% between April and June instead of 17.3%, he insisted. Mali's coup leaders should release former senior government officials who've been detained for more than a month since they seized power, a UN-appointed independent rights expert said on Wednesday. At least 13 of the 18 people arrested after the coup d'etat are still being held illegally at the Kati military camp in Bamako, said Alioune Tine in a statement. The development follows previous appeals by UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres and the African Union. Those still detained include the former Prime Minister, the former President of the National Assembly, and other former Malian officials, said Mr. Tine, who insisted that there was no legal basis for them to remain in custody. In an appeal to the leaders of the National Committee for the Salvation of the People, CNSP, the rights expert urged them to comply with Mali's international rights obligations and to release everyone who had been arrested during the coup and allow their families and lawyers to visit. Corruption on an epic scale is destroying any chance of a peaceful future for the people of South Sudan, the Human Rights Council heard on Wednesday. Chair of the Commission on Human Rights in South Sudan, Miasmin Suka, told member states that lives were being destroyed by graft during a debate about terrible abuses still happening in the war-torn country. Looting and pillage were arguably the main drivers of the conflict, Ms. Suka said. She insisted that while political elites were fighting for control of the country's oil and mineral resources, soldiers were still being offered the chance to abduct and rape women instead of receiving salaries. Echoing those concerns, the UN's Deputy Rights Chief, Nada Al-Nashif, highlighted an increase in intercommunal violence between January and July this year, particularly in Jonglei, Lakes, Warap, Unity and Western Bahr el-Ghazal states. Ms. Al-Nashif also welcomed positive developments regarding the revitalized peace agreement since the formation of the Transitional Government of National Unity in February, although implementation had been slow, she added. Finally, to New York and UN headquarters, where it's day two of the General Assembly's big debate session of world leaders, and the 75th time that the event has been held since the United Nations was founded. This year's event is almost totally virtual, but there's still plenty to follow. If you want to do so, just go to our website, unnews.org. That's www.news.un.org/en/events/UNGA75. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Law and Disorder. Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with one of the great journalists in America, Chris Hedges. We're speaking with Chris about the impending election and what's in the back of everybody's minds, what's going to happen after the election. Is fascism on the horizon and how we can stop it? We'll also speak with Nina Strike. She's the founder and director of the Global Peace Film Festival. We learn more about the film's lineup, which is running from Monday, September 21 until Sunday, October 4th, and where to go to see the films, plus interviews with the directors.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
We are living in extraordinary times. At the same time, we face both tremendous danger and extraordinary opportunity to its citizens. Our opportunity comes from the massive social mobilizations that we have not seen in 75 years. A young generation has risen up. White people are involved with black people who are providing leadership. Perhaps 20 million people have taken to the streets. Trump is desperate and resorts to stoking fear of violence, race-baiting, lying, explaining to his followers that all the unrest is due to agitators, Antifa, Marxists, and socialists. The Democratic Party has chosen to oppose Trump with Joe Biden. The best you can say about Biden is that he's not Trump. He has vowed to veto a Medicare for All bill if it comes across his desk. And he suggested that police violence could be curbed if they shot people in the legs, not in the chest. He's for giving police departments more money. The worst you can say about Biden and the Democratic Party is that they are not a bulwark against fascism. The big financial backers of the Democratic Party crushed the Sanders campaign, indicating they would rather have Trump than a social Democrat who would cost them money and raise expectations. Sanders, for his part, missed his historic moment twice when he refused to break from the Democratic Party in both 2016 and 2020. Instead, he performs the function of a sheepdog, herding people back into a moribund capitalist party that has nothing to offer as a way out of the combined crises of climate, the economy, race, health, and the escalating nuclear buildup. We speak today with return guest Chris Hedges about where we're at, how we got here, and what to do next. Chris Hedges is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He was the foreign correspondent for the New York Times for 15 years and served as Middle Eastern bureau chief. He's the host of Emmy Award-nominated RT America show On Contact and the author of numerous books, including America, The Farewell Tour, Empire of Illusion, and American Fascists, the Christian Right, and the War on America. Chris Hedges, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael.
Chris, Bertolt Brecht has written, quote, "How can anyone tell the truth about fascism unless he's willing to speak out against capitalism, which brings it forth? Those who are against fascism without being against capitalism, who lament only, are people who want to eat veal without slaughtering the calf," end quote. American neoliberal capitalism has held sway over the last 40 years, starting with Ronald Reagan. Chris, please talk about the USA as a disintegrating society.
Well, I would use Carl Polanyi's distinction of unfettered or unregulated capitalism as opposed to capitalism. Capitalism in any society is an insidious force. And how do we define capitalism? It is about the maximization of profit, no matter what you do, and the reduction of the cost of production, which is labor. Those are the twin goals of any capitalist enterprise. And when capitalism has no external controls, because it has no internal controls, then, in Polanyi's words, you create a mafia economy and a mafia state. And that's exactly what's happened in American society. Now, it's been a long process. It began by design in the early 1970s in reaction to the rise of popular movements in the 60s. And it was all laid out, and anyone can read it. It's the Powell Memo, 1971, written by Lewis Powell, who was the counsel for the Chamber of Commerce, later appointed to the Supreme Court. He actually singles out Ralph Nader by name. And it's about using corporate money to take control of not just democratic institutions, but cultural institutions, understanding that, as Gramsci, you know, wrote, cultural institutions are important forms of social control. And that process has been this kind of rolling or creeping corporate coup d'etat, turbocharged by the complete surrender of the Democratic Party under the Clinton administration, mirroring what Tony Blair did with the Labor Party, where they sold out the American working class, not to mention the working poor, to corporate power. And so you saw a series of moves by the Clinton administration, starting in 1994 with NAFTA, which was the greatest betrayal of the American working class since the 1947 Taft-Hartley Act, which makes it very difficult to organize and unionize and strike, the one weapon that workers have to push back against capital. The deregulation of the FCC, which is not a small move because it consolidated the control of, in particular, the electronic media, but not exclusively the electronic media, into the hands of a half dozen corporations, Comcast, Viacom, General Electric, you know, reducing acceptable opinion in political debate to what Dorothy Parker used to say about Katharine Hepburn's emotional range, that it went from A to B. So, you know, remember, if you go back a couple years, the whole debate about Syria, well, do we bomb them or do we bomb them and put boots on the ground? Like, and I speak as the former Middle East bureau chief of the New York Times and a fierce opponent of these endless wars from the beginning. Like, those are the two things we have to debate. Clinton, of course, ripped down the firewalls between commercial and investment banks by destroying the 1933 Glass-Steagall Act, which was put up to prevent the kind of crash that took place in 1929 and that subsequently took place in 2007 and 8. Clinton, with, you know, his ally Joe Biden, and this again is an important component, militarized the police and exploded the prison population. Why? Well, because if your manufacturing goes to places like Monterrey, Mexico, that's where GM is, and towns like Anderson, Indiana, which used to be a huge manufacturing center where people had unionized jobs with benefits and is turned into a wasteland, which it is, and workers in Mexico are making $3 an hour without benefits. So you have whole segments of the working class, and of course the people who suffer most are always people of color first, in particular African Americans. Then you need, if they're not integrated into the society, which in itself is a form of social control, as the sociologist Emile Durkheim points out, then you need other forms of social control, and that's lethal, unaccountable police forces that carry out reigns of terror. I don't think that's an exaggeration. In poor urban pockets, what Malcolm X called our internal colonies, and mass incarceration. All of this was done, or certainly the the seeds of it were planted by the Reagan administration, but it was really pushed through in a massive way by the Democratic Party, by the Clinton administration. So what in essence it did is create unregulated capitalism. So Marx calls capitalism a revolutionary force in that sense, that it will exploit unfettered, unregulated, uncontrolled. It will exploit everything. It turns everything into a commodity. The human beings become commodities. The natural world becomes a commodity that it exploits until exhaustion or collapse. So I would differ with Brecht only with that distinction. But we are certainly now living in an age when we all are forced, including the natural world, to kneel before the primacy of corporate profit, and often short-term corporate profit, at the expense of human life and the very ecosystem that sustains human life.
We're speaking with Chris Hedges. Chris, define fascism for us, particularly what's fascism American style?
So fascism has no coherent ideology. And if you look at the history of fascism, Italian fascism, for example, was very different from German fascism. Italian fascism never actually embraced the deep anti-Semitism of Germany. Its policies are completely contradictory because in the rise of the Nazi Party, like with the big strikes in Berlin, the Nazis allied with the communists. They used the word socialist because with the collapse of Weimar and the austerity program pushed through by the centrist government of Ebert and others, you know, they had to cater to, after the crash, to the international banking system. So they actually, like, abolished, if you can imagine, with massive unemployment benefits or unemployment insurance to pay the banks. Fascism is an emotional, it's hyper-masculine, it caters to emotions because its ideology is really almost absurdist. And there's a book, by the way, called Male Fantasies by Klaus I'll mispronounce his German name, but it's Theweleit, which is kind of brilliant, where he kind of seeks to discover the emotional core of fascism by looking at the Freikorps, which was the antecedents to the brown shirts and the mercenaries. But I think he's right in that it's an emotional, it appeals to an emotional void, perhaps, that is taking place within the society among disempowered people. It simplifies an understanding of a complex reality. So we see it in the United States. You know, why are you suffering? Well, it's because of 11 undocumented million undocumented workers who don't even earn minimum wage. It's ridiculous that that's why you've lost your job or your community is in free fall. But it works on an emotional level. It gives you targets, people of color, Antifa, whoever it is that you're then allowed to go after because, you know, like the Jews, or if I covered the war in Yugoslavia, or it's the Muslims, or whoever it is, it legitimates violence against those groups, but it's emotional. And I mean, the thing about fascism, and I'll get to your question about American fascism, is that unlike communism, it relies on an alliance with the capitalist class, the great industrialists in Germany like Krupp and others who made fortunes under the Nazi regime. They didn't actually like the Nazis. It's an uneasy alliance in the same way that you see an uneasy alliance with Trump, who does all of the bidding that the Wall Street and the war industry and everybody wants, but he's just so vulgar and distasteful, they'd prefer to get Biden in because he'll do the same thing with a little more decorum. But fascism always takes on the coloring of, this goes back to Italy and Germany, it cloaks itself in the coloring of the national mythology. So with Mussolini, he kept talking about the resurrection of the Roman Empire. He identified with Augustus. With Nazi fascism, it went back to Teutonic myth. And in the United States, it cloaks itself in Christianized white fascism. And I wrote a book, as you know, called American Fascist, The Christian White and the War in America. I did not use the word fascist lightly, and I am a seminary graduate, grew up in the church. These people are heretics. They have used the iconography and language of the Christian religion to essentially sacralize the worst elements of American imperialism, white supremacy, and capitalism. And they're a very powerful, if unseen, force. Because they have created, hermetically sealed, tens of millions of Americans within their world view, which is very much like Trump's world view. And that's why there's such a symbiotic relationship between Trump and the magical thinkers within the Christian right, who continue to support Trump, who don't believe in science, who are, you know, celebrate the Confederacy and the anti-communist witch hunts of the 50s, and Pence. Of course, there are many people around Trump. Trump has he has an ideological void. It's just narcissism. But there are many people around Trump, Pompeo, Betsy DeVos, Michael Pence, Ben Carson, other who are stalwart members of the Christian right and have very effectively in the last 3.5 years filled that ideological void for Trump with the tenets of this Christian fascism.
Chris, do you think that Joe Biden and the Democratic Party will do much to, in your words, quote, restore the social bonds or address the social inequality of tens of millions of Americans, end quote? Do you have any hope in Biden and the Democratic Party putting forward substantial solutions to the racism and social inequality and other institutional problems that spawned Donald Trump and his followers in the first place?
No, they created it. Biden's statement about how police should shoot people in the legs,
yeah,
I suppose, rather than the head, is that a step forward? He's already said that if Congress passes Medicare for All, he'll veto it. They've already ruled out any kind of a meaningful jobs program, and unemployment is close to 20%. They've fixed the numbers in all sorts of ways and have for many years. I mean, if you work for 1 hour a week in the United States, you're counted as employed. If you stop looking for work, you're no longer on the unemployment rolls. If you're furloughed with no chance of going back to your job, you're not on the unemployment rolls. So real numbers, the LA Times did a story a while ago estimating it was 17%. We don't know, but it's certainly far above 10 or 11%. And then, of course, many of those people who are employed, a third of the workforce, are living hand-to-mouth, earning minimum wage without benefits. So, no, Biden is a creature of this system. He has built his career on it. He was a tool of the credit card companies, which are all based in Delaware, including gave his son Hunter a very lucrative job while he was in the Senate. And that's the problem. We're not examining the social, economic, political, cultural decay that has created figures like Trump, given rise to these right-wing proto-fascist militias, which are walking around cities like Portland or Kenosha with automatic weapons, I mean military-grade weapons. And then we are just now seeing the first incipient clashes, the creation of martyrs, which is really, really dangerous. I saw the same thing in Yugoslavia. So all of the tinder that is lying about that could ignite widespread violent conflagrations is ominously stacked. You have millions of disenfranchised white Americans who are seething with rage against the ruling elites and a bankrupt liberal elite that presided over this stagnation and social inequality. And you have millions more alienated young men and women who have been completely locked out of the economy. They have no realistic prospect for advancement or integration. And they're gripped by this same emotional void. I mean, their fury is similar against the government structures. It's often expressed through Antifa, this anti-fascism. But what you're creating are these polarized segments, enraged segments of the population, and the political center is, as we watch, disintegrating. I do not consider, by the way, Joe Biden or the Democratic Party to be part of the political center. The Democratic Party under Clinton transformed itself into the Republican Party and pushed the Republican Party so far to the right it became insane.
And it became the white man's party.
Yes, it was always playing, you know, in my book, American Fascists, and I spent 2 years hanging out with these people, I said, you know, all the Republican elites, the Bushes, the Cheneys, the Rumsfeld, they all considered the Christian right to be the useful idiots, but they had the numbers. And I said, you know, you better be careful because the useful idiots one day are going to take over, and that's what happened.
Let's talk about crisis cults. That's what anthropologists call the crisis cults. Would you say that this applies to the Christian right and followers of Donald Trump?
Yes, the Christian right has all of the characteristics of what anthropologists call crisis cults. What are crisis cults? They're when you can't deal, reality is so oppressive, the evictions, the joblessness, the struggle with addictions, the domestic and sexual violence, the inability to free yourself from gambling, alcoholism, opioids, the hopelessness, the fact that you're going nowhere, you know your kids are going nowhere, the stress of poverty or near poverty. These lead people, you know, essentially it's the shutting of all other avenues by which they can actualize themselves. It leads them into the arms of what we call crisis cults. Crisis cults are, and this is what fascism is, it's what communism in its most virulent form was. It's utopian. It severs itself from the reality, fact-based world. It elevates you to a mythological status. Let's say, for instance, you're white. Suddenly you not only deify the white Christian experience in the United States, but the Confederacy, and rewrite history. Somehow the Confederacy is not fought anymore for slavery. It's fought for states' rights, which is ridiculous because all you have to do is read the constitutions of every Confederate state, and they all talk about, almost all of them talk about the primacy of defending slavery. So, and then you just check out. And that was also true with the ethnic nationalists in Yugoslavia. And you can't communicate. You can't have a rational communication with people who think that, you know, Adam and Eve were real and were in the Garden of Eden with the dinosaurs. It doesn't work. But if you push back against these people, you engender a great deal of anger, because what you're really doing is trying to push them back into the rational, fact-based, Cartesian world that almost destroyed them. That's why they're so virulent in terms of their hatred of people who come from that world. And when I finished my book, American Fascists, in the last chapter, I said the only way to blunt this movement, you're not going to argue them out of it. The only way to handle this crisis cult is to reintegrate these people into the society. And that, of course, is what the Democrats and Biden will not do because, of course, they work for Goldman Sachs and Citibank. I mean, indeed, Biden's, I've heard, there's talk about putting Jamie Dimon, who's a criminal, I mean, that's not even disputable, as Treasury Secretary. He's talking to Larry Summers. He's talking to all the old architects of the mess. So, yeah, that crisis cult will grow, and it will grow because the ruling elites have failed to extend the boosting of unemployment benefits, the $600 a month. They have failed to extend the moratorium on foreclosures and bank repossessions, and you see the capitalist class responding. So what are they doing? Well, all the banks are not lending any money. They're hoarding it. Why? Because they know that there's going to be a wave of foreclosures, of bankruptcies, of people unable to pay their credit card debt, their student loans, their car loans, their household debt. They know what's coming. That's why you can't lend any. That's why you can't get any personal loans. I mean, big banks like Wells Fargo have publicly said you cannot get loans, and it's because of that. So that will exacerbate these crisis cults because people can have limits; they can only push so far.
Chris Hedges, what do you think about Bernie Sanders supporting Biden instead of leaving the Democratic Party? Do you think he missed his historical moment?
He missed his historical moment in 2016 when hundreds of Sanders delegates walked out carrying Bernie signs, chanting, what does democracy look like? This is what democracy looks like. And Bernie, who desperately wanted to avoid a confrontation with the Clinton campaign, was sending out message after message, which was written by Clinton staffers, calling on people to respect the nomination and be responsible. But, you know, this has always been, I think, Bernie Sanders' fatal flaw. Remember, Sanders has been part of the political establishment for a long time, and he was campaigning on behalf of Bill Clinton in 1996, after Clinton had passed NAFTA, after he'd passed the Omnibus Crime Bill, when it was clear that Clinton had sold out working men and women. He did miss his historical moment. I actually did an event with Bernie the night before the climate march, with Shama Sawant was there, along with Naomi Klein and Bill McKibben. And Shama pushed him and said, you know, you're not going to build a viable alternative within the Democratic Party. You have to step out. We're not going to build it within a particular election cycle. And Bernie's response was, I don't want to end up like Ralph Nader. Now, Sanders isn't wrong that if he had defied the Democratic Party establishment, he would have ended up as a pariah like Nader. They don't target his Senate seat. You know, he runs as an independent in Vermont because he caucuses with the Democratic Party, he has seniority within the party. Schumer's been holding out, you know, committee chairmanships for him if the Democrats retake control of the Senate. And Sanders spent the last 4 years really licking Schumer's boots. I mean, there's kind of these very sad photographs of Sanders and Democratic elites and Sanders off to the side. He was, I think, given this meaningless position of director of outreach. I can't remember what the actual title was. And he thought that if he, I guess, I don't, you know what he thought, but it appeared that he thought that if he played the game, they'd give him another shot, and they didn't. I mean, you take away the corporate money from Biden, you take away the corporate money from Clinton, and they're not the nominee. Sanders would have been the nominee. They kept the superdelegates. They could not vote in the first round, but in a convention where nobody gets a plurality, they would have killed Sanders in the second, even if he'd made it. There was no chance. So, and the superdelegates are all lobbyists and, you know, governors and ex-senators, and they're all part of the Democratic Party donor class and hierarchy. So, and they're appointed by the DNC. And you have to be a superdelegate to be on the DNC. So, but I think in the end, Sanders lacked political courage. He, you know, ended up being too much of a careerist, and I think he was always morally as well as temperamentally unfit to lead the kind of fight that needs to be fought.
You've said that in comparison with what lies ahead, this may be the good times. What will things be like if Biden and the Democratic Party replace Trump? I'm thinking about the economy, police, endless wars, military budget, prisons. social inequality, healthcare, women's rights, racism, ecocide that's going on. Let's say that Biden does win. What do you think things will be like?
Well, the internal violence will get worse because, of course, these crisis cults, and Trump functions as a cult figure. He doesn't function as a politician. That's why everybody's reading the opposition to Trump wrong. They're responding to him as if he's a legitimate political figure. The Trump cult leaders, and Margaret Singer, her book, Cults in Our Midst, and those who have written about cults, that great book by Marilu, The Rape of the Mind, and others, they understand that when you are identify with a cult leader, when you feel that you are powerless, you want the cult leader to be omnipotent because that identification with the cult leader substitutes or gives you the illusion of power. So his followers want him to flout all the rules and lie and flip the middle finger at the establishment. And so sitting up and, you know, day after day listing all his lies, he's impervious to that. It doesn't affect a cult leader. And so the mainstream establishment has never figured out how to deal with Trump. But if Trump loses, I think all the ominous warnings are correct. He isn't going to admit that he lost. He's already stoking violence, inciting violence. That's part of his rhetoric. That will get worse because the ruling elites, Democrat and Republican, have failed to respond to the looming crisis, economic and political, that I just outlined in terms of evictions and, you know, unemployment and everything else, then, yeah, things are going to get worse. And these wars, which are just hollowing the country out from the inside, aren't going to end. Wholesale surveillance, we're the most watched, spied upon, monitored, eavesdropped, photographed population in human history. And I, as a reporter, covered the Stasi state in East Germany. None of that's going away under Biden. So all of the conditions of corporate tyranny that were implanted in large part by the Democratic Party, and Biden wasn't just Biden, I mean Obama. I'm very close to Julian Assange and would be in London, but for COVID, was in London sitting in the courtroom at the last hearing. Biden will extradite and torture and lock Assange away just like Trump. The mechanisms of control that are now in place through militarized police forces, mass incarceration, wholesale surveillance, these systemic problems, there is no daylight between the two parties on these. They walk in lockstep on this. And what that really means is kind of corporate tyranny.
So what do you say to leftists who are urging people to support Biden as the lesser of two evils who can be influenced by the left?
I say they live in a fantasy of their own creation. It's a form of political infantilism. The whole idea that politics is reduced to political personalities. You know, you have to look at people's voting records. They didn't, by the way. Obama's Senate voting record, he was only 2 years in the Senate, was appalling. It was one corporate giveaway after another. That's all the power brokers look at. They understand that the rhetoric is done, you know, for the electorate, and that once power is achieved, the lobbyists will get to work writing all the legislation and running everything. So, I mean, the political America has always been a country, I think, infected with a kind of infantilism, and the left is not immune to that.
What do you think about the Green Party? You've been a supporter of it in the past, and in fact, you were Ralph Nader's speechwriter. What's your position on the Green Party today?
Well, the Green Party is a pretty dysfunctional party. As much as I like Howie Hawkins, and I intend to vote for him. I mean, look, if voting was that effective, as Emma Goldman said, it would be illegal. It's hardly going to change much. But I am close, I've long been close to Ralph Nader, and I think Ralph was right, that if 5, 10, 15 million people walked out of the Democratic Party, the agenda of the Green Party would have leverage. Now, that didn't happen. And they effectively demonized Ralph the same way they've demonized Julian. Politics is a game of fear. Politics is a game of pressure. And Biden isn't going to respond if there isn't pressure. To somehow, you know, think that Kamala Harris or Biden's, you know, goodwill will, it's just, but it just shows the political immaturity of, I think, the left. Always remember that, you know, so the liberals always talk a good game. I live in Princeton. I'm surrounded by them. But when they step in the voting booth, they always vote for that law and order candidate. I mean, there's a wonderful kind of insight into that. A couple years ago, the food banks in Trenton were running out of food, and so all the wealthy white, you know, upper middle class people of Princeton, where I live, were collecting food. And I went down to give a few bags of food, and the woman said, "Oh, that's good, because if they run out of food, they'll come here." And I thought, boy, that is exactly what they think. So, you know, the internal rot of the American empire, and read Joseph Taner's Collapse of Complex Civilizations, where he talks about all of the ways traditional civilizations collapse. That's already far advanced and going to be stopped by Biden.
So what gives you optimism? Where does hope live?
You know, as a war correspondent, I don't share America's mania for hope. You know, I covered the war in El Salvador for 5 years, and so many of people I worked with were killed. I finally just came to the point that I was going to die there. You know, you have to make a very cold assessment of weapon systems as a war correspondent, you know, what's down at the end of the road, and then judge it. People who are kind of Pollyannish or, you know, have unrealistic hopes don't survive in extreme situations. I think part of our responsibility as mature adults is to accept the bleakness before us, the eco side that is unraveling. I mean, look at Oregon, look at California, look at the ice sheets, and then respond. I think that, you know, like Camus, rebellion itself is a form of empowerment, even if it doesn't succeed. Solzhenitsyn writes the same thing in the Gulag Archipelago, especially the third volume. It's about resistance. It's about making a moral stance. It's about pushing back. And every once in a while, you win. But, you know, to trust at this point the system itself with an unrealistic hope is, I think, the worst form of defeatism.
What if Bernie Sanders would have taken up Jill Stein's offer, walked out of the Democratic Party, joined the Green Party, and formed an independent force? Is that something that you think about?
Well, that's what he should have done. But, you know, they would have destroyed him because it's going to take. I mean, look, Syriza, 10 years before it took power in Greece, was pulling at 4%, which is about what Nader at his height was pulling. But we've got to step outside of the system, and because of the eco side, there's no time left. I'm a strong supporter of Extinction Rebellion. They've just put the co-founder of Extinction Rebellion and other leaders in jail in anticipation of an action in very harsh conditions. Roger Hallam, who I'm corresponding with, you know, people who are in touch with him, he's only been allowed out of his cell for an hour the last week. He has no books. They're trying to do to him what they're doing to Julian, what they did to all sorts of great Palestinian activists at the behest of Israel after 9/11, Saad Hashmi and others, the Holy Land Foundation. So we're going to have to bring the system down, and we're going to have to do it the way I saw hundreds of thousands of people do it in Eastern Europe. I covered the revolutions in East Germany, Czechoslovakia, and Romania. Romania is a little different, but that's how we're going to have to do it. And the longer we sit around and wait for the Democratic Party to wake up, the more we're, you know, pounding more nails in our coffin.
We've only got 5 minutes left, Chris Hedges, but I wanted to end our discussion with the situation with Julian Assange. His extradition hearing has resumed in London, as you know. The USA wants to try him for espionage and send him to prison for 175 years. He's an Australian citizen, a journalist working in London, who told the truth about American war crimes back in 2010 when he published, among other things, a video given to him by Chelsea Manning, which showed an American helicopter gunship murdering civilians, a couple of children, and two Reuters journalists in the streets of Baghdad. If Julian is successfully extradited and then prosecuted in the Eastern District of Virginia under the Espionage Act as a spy, what will it mean for journalism?
It means that it will be utterly impossible for any journalist to shine a light on the inner workings of power. It is absolutely catastrophic. And, you know, figures within the establishment echo that. There's a YouTube video you can watch of myself, Daniel Ellsberg, who leaked the Pentagon Papers, and James Goodall, who was the lead counsel for the New York Times when the government tried to stop the New York Times from publishing the Pentagon Papers. And it's worth watching because it kind of lays out what's happening. It sets a precedent that is fundamental to all systems of totalitarianism, and that is that the press cannot hold power accountable. That's what this at its core is about, and why I've been so fierce in my defense of Julian, who I have visited in the Ecuadorian embassy with Michael Ratner, usually. As Michael Ratner understood that you know, this marks a momentous, if Julian is extradited, charged, and found guilty — he's been charged, but if he's found guilty and in prison, this really radically changes the media landscape forever within the United States and pushes us far, far closer to a totalitarian system, a species of what the political philosopher Sheldon Wolin called inverted totalitarianism, which really is just a way of saying that all of the iconography, language, institutions remain like the late Roman Republic, but all of the levers of power are in the hands of corporate interests.
You know, Michael Ratner had Julian Assange. That was his last client before he died. You know, we've set up a defense committee. The website is AssangeDefense.org. Noam Chomsky, Daniel Ellsberg, and Alice Walker are their honorary chairs. And I would suggest to our listeners that if they want to learn more about the Assange situation, they go to AssangeDefense.org. Chris, before I have to let you go, tell me, how can people follow your work?
So I don't have any social media, but there is a guy who runs a Twitter account that posts all of my stuff. It's Chris Lynn Hedges on Twitter. That usually gets, you know, whatever the latest article. We were all fired from Truthdig after we went on strike when the publisher tried to fire Bob Scheer. Bob's now set up SheerPost.com, so I write for him every 2 weeks. I'm just just yesterday finished my book for Simon and Schuster on mass incarceration. So I've only been writing twice a month or every 2 weeks for him. I may go back to a weekly column. And then, of course, On Contact. I have this show on RT America that is also, it's always posted on the Twitter account, but you can also find it on YouTube.
Great. I'm on all of those, Chris. I follow your work faithfully. I admire what you're doing. I'm so appreciative of your being a guest on Law and Disorder. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Michael.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
At the end of September each year since 2003, the Global Peace Film Festival has used the power of film to advance peace. The festival views peace not as the absence of conflict, but as a framework for channeling, processing, and resolving conflict through respectful and nonviolent means. This year, the festival will be on virtual and runs from Monday, September 21 until Sunday, October 4. In keeping with the spirit of the festival, the films highlight themes such as civil rights, civil liberties, environmental justice, ethics, immigration, music, social justice, voting, wellness, and wildlife. Each year, the program is carefully curated to create a place for open dialogue, using the films as catalysts for change. Today on Law & Disorder, we catch up with festival's founder and executive director, Nina Strike, for a few previews of the 2020 lineup. Nina Strike, welcome to Law & Disorder.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Nina, several of the titles this year are on civil liberties as a theme. Could you give us an idea of what they are and what they're about?
Well, the first film I'll tell you about is called 16 Bars, and it actually follows a group of prisoners who, in a Virginia jail, in a makeshift recording studio, where four men collaborate on an album with Grammy-winning recording artist Speech from Arrested Development. The film follows these four people through not only the program that allows them to record the album, but also the difficulties they have, you know, what brought them to the prison, and as returning citizens, what challenges they face. They're not like head-on civil liberties films, but almost everything addresses civil liberties. So A Concerned Citizen, Civics in Action, follows Dr. Ricky Ott, who's an environmentalist fighting against oil companies, particularly in the Gulf and also in Alaska. She sort of predicted the Exxon Valdez spill, and she realizes that the most important thing is for engaged citizenry, and really pursues active citizenship. So that's another one. Let's see, what else? Swing State Florida introduces us to three different communities throughout the state of Florida who are basically marginalized communities who feel left behind in the, you know, when politicians come to town during the election seeking their votes, but then basically leave them behind as soon as the election is over. And there's several other. Oh, Waging Change is another film, and this is about the campaign to end the tipped minimum wage around the country, because there are still, I think it's 17 states still have a tipped minimum wage on their books. So,
what do you mean by tipped minimum wage?
Tipped minimum wage is if you work in a restaurant or in a business, in a company for which you're tipped, instead of the regular state minimum wage, they can pay you $2.17 an hour and assume that the tips will make up the difference. And that actually still exists. It does not exist in New York. It does not exist in California. There are several other states that have disallowed that. But in many states, including Florida, the tipped minimum wage is actually $2.17. And legally, companies are not required to pay more than that an hour. So obviously, it's almost impossible to survive on that.
No, that's really a disgrace. You've provided interviews with many filmmakers. Are there any international people that you want to mention?
Sure. We had a wonderful interview with Australians, and where we were speaking to them on different days, which is always interesting. Can Art Stop a Bullet is the film. The interview is available. Unfortunately, the film is only available in Florida. And also we had a conversation with Barak Heyman in Israel. We just had a conversation. We have three films about Costa Rica, and one of the filmmaking teams is based in, most of them are based in Italy, so we spoke to her. And then we have another film where the filmmaker, Mantra Sounds Into Silence, the film is, the filmmaker is in Spain. She's a Swiss filmmaker based in Spain. Let's see, were there any others? Oh, yes, wonderful film called Our Gorongosa about Mozambique. The film was made in Mozambique, and we spoke to one of the people who runs the program in the Gorongosa National Park to help. She's the education director, and she helps women, actually mainly girls, stay in school, among other things. And the film is about the, you know, largely about the elephants in the Gorongosa National Park and the how the community deals with the elephants, because they'll come across the river into the towns and cause quite a lot of destruction, and so how do they deal with that? And wonderful interview with the education person there.
When you mentioned three films about Costa Rica, it struck me that that's such a special environmental place. Are the films about the environment in Costa Rica?
Largely about the, all of them focus on the environment, and the environment is so critical in Costa Rica because it's part of the, you know, ecotourism is one of the ways that the country is thriving. One of the other things that's so special about Costa Rica is that back in the 50s, I think it was, they abolished the standing military in order to redirect the money that used to go to the military towards education, the environment, and healthcare for Costa Rican citizens. And so some of the films touch on that. They each approach the country from a different point of view. And we had this one panel discussion with the filmmakers from all three films, talking to a couple of professors who take student trips from a college, who take student trips down to Costa Rica. So it was really quite an engaging conversation.
Who makes up your audience, Nina? And how many people do you think tune in to these films and interviews?
Well, this is the first year we're doing it virtually because of the pandemic. We usually have the festival in person down in Central Florida, mainly in Orlando and around the Orlando area. And we've had generally about 6,000 or 7,000 people totally come to the festival. But this year is entirely different, and the sky's the limit. We hope everybody will come, will watch a film, and want to watch more after they've seen one. I'm talking about the feature films. There's also short films in the program. The feature films are ticketed, but it's a very inexpensive ticket. It's a $5 ticket per film. There's short films that are available for free, and those come from around the world as well. So we really don't know what's going to, you know, how many people will tune in, but we don't have any limits on it this year, which is wonderful.
Well, we're speaking with Nina Strike from the Global Peace Film Festival. If people will get a pen, one of my last questions is going to be how you can tune into the film festival. But before I ask you that, Nina, can you tell us what is the process by which a film is chosen?
Well, we have a submission process that starts in February and ends in May. Most film festivals use something called Film Freeway, where filmmakers from around the world can submit their films, and the film festivals can solicit films. And basically, filmmakers decide, oh, this is a festival that I think my film should be in. We get several hundred submissions each year and have to watch every single one of them and decide what's going to work and what's not. And one of the things we really pay attention to is our audiences. Who is our audience and who do we want to reach? And in Central Florida, what we want to do is we want to encourage activism among the people who come to the festival. We want to use the films, creative media to inspire people to do something about what they've seen. So that's one of the things we look, we work with a lot of community partners. And another thing that we do in terms of finding films is we go to several film festivals throughout the year. We're in touch. Many of the filmmakers come back to us with their next films because they had such a good experience with the Global Peace Film Festival. It's an ongoing process to decide on what's going to be in the festival, and we try to be as diverse as possible in terms of the selection, so that each year there's basically a lot of things to choose from.
Well, it sounds to me like you've got a great job, Nina. If you don't mind, could I ask you a personal question? I mean, what was it that caused you to develop your sensibilities towards this project? How did you come to undertake this?
I have been a lifelong activist, and I have also been passionate about the art of film and communications and media. And so this was a perfect coming together of my two passions.
Yeah, I'll say. What kind of problems did you have this year when you had to do it on a virtual festival? I know my son is the producer of the Brooklyn Folk Festival, and he's been doing it for 14 years, and this year he's got to do it online. It's been a real test for them.
It is a challenge, but it hasn't been. It's actually been kind of exciting because we're able to. You know, it's called the Global Peace Film Festival, and usually people have had to come to Orlando to see it. So now people around the world, not only do we get films from around the world to the festival, but also people can come to the festival from around the world as well. So that's kind of exciting. The challenge, technology, really. I mean, you know, we've been doing all these Zoom recordings, as you mentioned, with the filmmakers, and Zoom is not a terribly stable platform. So those are issues. We had to figure out, you know, filmmakers are skeptical about the protection of their intellectual property. You know, they don't want people to be able to take their work without them being paid for it. And so, which is something that does, you know, they do need festivals. The festivals are part of the distribution ecosystem for especially independent documentary filmmakers. But that's also, you know, that was an issue because the platforms for film festivals have sprung up really quickly during, you know, at the beginning of the pandemic. But we chose a platform that we're quite happy with. So there were a lot of challenges, but it's also kind of exciting because it's a whole new world out there. And I think we're going to continue to use some of the things that we started using virtually. I think we're going to, you know, continue that as well as hopefully being able to get back to showing films in, you know, in a theater in person.
Well, here's the question I promised our listeners. How can people review the various films and interviews that you've put out there?
Well, the website is peacefilmfest.org. Yes, peacefilmfest.org. Everything is there. The interviews are there. The Global Peace Film Festival has a YouTube channel as well that has some additional content besides the interviews for these. When the pandemic, you know, when we all sort of got locked down, we had to cancel some live programming, and so we actually started to do some interviews with filmmakers whose work was available on different websites for free in the month of April because everybody was like, what are we going to do now? And so a lot of small distributors were opening up the password protection on all their films so people had something to do at home. And many of those were, you know, we saw a lot of films by filmmakers who'd been in the festival and films that had been in the festival. So we said, well, let's have a question and answer session with them and put it on, you know, do it on Zoom. And what we found was that, and the reason we're doing the interviews that are for the festival the way we are, is we found that people were not watching the films first, but they were inspired to go to the films from the discussion. So we started doing that. We're going to continue doing that. And so it was actually a really interesting process to come to decide how we were going to structure this year's festival. I mean, initially we were thinking, well, we have to schedule, you know, every night we have to schedule a live Zoom. And those are unwieldy and not necessarily satisfactory if if there's technical issues, which there usually are, or if people haven't seen the film before and you're talking and the Q&A is more, you know, is geared towards people who have seen the film. So you have this balance. But the good thing about the virtual platform is most of the films are available for the full 14 days. So you can, they're available 24/7. So you can watch a film on your own schedule. And the interviews, you can watch them before or after you see the film. If you're interested in something, you might want to sort of check in with it, see what the film's about before you decide to watch a film. So we'll see what happens, but we're kind of happy with how we've developed this, our virtual festival. I mean, everybody's doing it differently, but, you know, this is how we decided to do it, and I hope people enjoy it.
Yeah, I'm sure that I will. We're speaking with Nina Strike, who's the producer of the Global Peace Film Festival. Nina, before I have to say goodbye to you, give us that website one more time so people can tune in.
It's peacefilmfest.org.
Great. Nina Strike, thank you so much for your good work on this, and thank you for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much, Michael.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.